Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from the Lake Orange, Ethel versus Stone.
May I please report, Stephen Wright, which is an argument for the Lake Orange. The Lake Orange has reserved 5 minutes to rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. We are here today because of the failure of the trial court to exercise its discretion in implementing Rule 174 as to 22 cases which it has consolidated for trial. What we are requesting is that the court, this court, order the trial court to order separate trials of these cases and to require compliance with Rule 174 by examining each of these cases to determine whether or not consolidation is proper within the rules of 174 and as the cases have interpreted that rule.
Harris County District Courts have been trying asbestos cases in Bruce for 7 years now.
I suspect that they have. I don't know exactly how long, Your Honor, but that's certainly true.
Some parameters of how many plaintiffs have been grouped before?
I know that counsel for plaintiffs have presented that in their brief. It has ranged anywhere, they say, from I think the high was the Chatham case of around 289 plaintiffs. I don't know what the lower end of that is. Sometimes it's my understanding that the courts have, and remember these are products cases, of course, they have consolidated cases of maybe in the neighborhood of 20 cases. Many times when you get to trial because of settlements, there are many fewer cases that actually go to trial, anywhere from 5 to 12, and of course I'm sure there are others that are more than that.
How far away were these 22 from going to trial at the time of these members?
Well, if I understand the court,
I'm just wondering what these 22 might have reasonably been expected to shrink down to.
Oh, you're talking about if we were to proceed to trial. I do not foresee at this time that any of these cases would be settled prior to trial, if that answers the court's question.
Mr. Rice, I'm just going to clear. Are you taking the position that two or more cases should never be consolidated, or that it would be appropriate to consolidate cases under some set of circumstances?
My position, Your Honor, is that these are negligence cases. It's going to be difficult, certainly more difficult than it is for products cases to be consolidated because, for instance, here we're dealing with four different, even with the four defendants that are involved in these cases, we're dealing with four different types of work sites. We have a steel mill.
I understand that, but just as far as your overarching argument here, you take the position there should never be consolidation?
I would like to take that position, but realistically, I don't feel that in this day and time that is going to happen. I think that in certain circumstances, certainly there are going to have to be some consolidations.
Thank you.
Well, what are the parameters that you think would be appropriate for those consolidations in these type of cases, these asbestos premises cases?
I think that we have in our briefing pointed out the Malcolm factors that or Maryland factors, whatever you want to call them. I think that there are certainly some of the some of those factors that are more important perhaps than others. I think the question of the common work site makes sure that that in these types of cases, at least each plaintiff who goes to trial has a claim against each defendant, so that the defendant doesn't have to sit there and be involved in a case in which he's really not a defendant. The question of common types of cancer or common types of disease. The courts that have reviewed that issue have found it particularly troublesome where different types of diseases have been consolidated.
But as a practical matter, how many cases could you actually consolidate if the court were to adopt and apply those factors? We've got apparently plaintiffs who worked at a number of different sites over a number of years. Who have varying injuries. How many of those different cases could you consolidate where the factors would be common?
If I understand what Your Honor is saying, As to these 22, there is actually only one plaintiff who worked at four different work sites among the five trial defendants involved in the case. So as to these 22, for instance, you could only consolidate on the issue of a common work site one of those plaintiffs. There are a number of different cancers alleged here, a number of different diseases. There's, as I recall, there are five different diseases alleged here, from mesothelioma down to pleural cases.
I think someone is asking about a broader question, which is, if a court were to adopt the Malcolm factors,
yes, sir.
Is there some finite number larger than which you shouldn't try the cases together, even if they meet all those criteria?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that there is. As Mr. Rafkin said, in his own experience, once you get above, in any case, basically, four or five or six plaintiffs, you're really having a problem with a jury making a decision separately as to those plaintiffs. So my position would be, once you get above that number, that you are really stretching the ability of a jury to perform its duty.
Going back to my question, though,
yes.
Let's say you first focus on the work site, and you've got a group of plaintiffs who'd all worked at the same two or three or four sites. Then you look at the type of injury, but they all have different cancers, or maybe some don't have cancer, but they have some other disease, so that would break up the group. It seems that if you take each of these factors and try to apply them to any one group, you're going to end up fracturing the group so that you have very few, if any, consolidation.
I appreciate the court's concern there. I think that foremost in my mind is the issue of not trying the different types of diseases together. And I think that that was recognized in many of the cases that have been litigated where you are joining cancer cases and non-cancer cases. They have found particular trouble in basically what the jury is able to do insofar as attribution, particularly if they have found that future damages in those cases, the jury has awarded tremendous amount of future damages because they see the specter of a cancer case before them and think that that because a lesser case is involved there, that person is also going to get cancer.
What would be wrong with regard to the type of injury with having one single dividing line, and that would be those with cancer and those with non-cancer complaints?
Well, that would certainly be a possibility. There would be a dividing line there. There are, I guess, three different types of cancers, basically. There's mesothelioma, there is lung cancer, and then there are other cancers that some people say that are attributable to asbestos exposure. And then if you make that dividing line to the other side of that, there would be pulmonary asbestosis and pleural cases. The only problem I see, or the basic problem I see, is that certainly lung cancer, you are going to have many more factors involved in the cause of those cancers. That is smoking primarily. Most of these people were smokers. Mesothelioma is not, at least at this time, thought to be related to smoking. The other problem is, even as to pleural cases, basically, it is a benign finding, that is either a plaque. There is no pulmonary fibrosis, and just because you have a plaque on your lungs does not mean that that is going to progress into pulmonary fibrosis, which is the pulmonary asbestosis cases. So I see a problem in joining those types of cases together.
Well, if we take these in order, it seems like if you have a plaintiff that sued several different defendants because that plaintiff had worked over time at all of those places, I wouldn't think you would want to split up, divide that plaintiff's case into different trials among those defendants, would you?
I would certainly think that a plaintiff's case is going to be tried only once, if that is the court's inquiry.
So then what would you look for next? Other plaintiffs who had the same type of injury who had the identical workplaces?
To the extent that you could do that. I'm not suggesting that you're going to be able to do that in each case, but I think as far as you can, the further you can narrow that, then you're going to be more appropriate in your consolidation.
I'm just trying to get at the practicalities. If you recognize that some consolidation would be appropriate in the real world of asbestos litigation, particularly in premises cases, how do you apply those factors?
And I again, going back, I think that the most important issue probably is the issue of the different types of diseases not being grouped together. And then from there, you just have to take a weighting factor. I think that the common work sites is an important issue as well. As I was mentioning in the opening remarks, these are, I think it is important in these cases to realize that these are not products liability suits that are against these defendants. They are negligence actions, and therefore, insofar as the evidence that is going to come out, the focus is necessarily going to be on the conduct of the parties and not on a product itself. So you're not going to have common issues or common evidence insofar as a defective product is concerned, whether or not there's a defective design of a product, whether or not there was an improper or a failure to warn. And I think this affects the amount of common evidence that is going to be admissible in these cases and the common factors.
Mr. Rice, over here.
I'm sorry.
Are they all premises liability-based theories?
Yes, Your Honor. These are, they're...
So is it, if I understand that theory, it's that the defendants created a dangerous condition that they knew about and failed to warn their employees or subcontractors or so forth?
Yes, these are not
so
employee cases.
So isn't that one common theory of legal liability that pervades every one of them, regardless of the disease that results?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
And the argument made by the respondent is that Rule 174A requires only a common fact or a common question of law. Isn't that met under the facts of these cases?
I was, yesterday afternoon after I left my office, I was served with that supplemental brief.
Me too.
So I have not had an opportunity to explore it further, but I read through it once. I found it quite frankly surprising that an argument would be made that one single fact can make these cases consolidatable without consideration of anything else. I do not think that that is what the courts have said, what the Supreme Court has said. Basically, what the courts, I believe, have said is that you have to look at all the facts and circumstances in order to determine whether or not a commonality exists, but once even you find that commonality exists, you've got to go further. You've got to determine whether or not prejudice to the defendant or to the plaintiff is going to result from the consolidation, or if jury confusion is going to result as a result of that consolidation.
Excuse me, may I break in for a moment?
Yes.
I would ask Mr. Adams to make have a question about a briefcase that's in the courtroom. I think we're going to take a break while this briefcase is in. And we'll just clear the courtroom and we'll start right back up where we are. Thank you. Be seated. How much time does Mr. Rice have remaining?
7 minutes.
Thank you.
In continuing the argument, I think it's important to note that the plaintiffs in these cases are making much of an allegation of judicial efficiency requiring consolidation of these cases. And yet the plaintiffs are maintaining two separate lawsuits in the courts of Harris County for the same injury. That is that each of these 22 plaintiffs and all of the other 365 plaintiffs that Plaintiffs' Counsel represents against these defendants have separate product liability suits against the product manufacturers in Harris County that they're maintaining at the same time that they are maintaining these other separate lawsuits against the premises liability defendants. So in one hand, they cry about judicial efficiency being necessary because, or consolidation being necessary for judicial efficiency, but on the other hand, they lack judicial efficiency when they file two lawsuits.
Don't you think maybe they did that to avoid the argument that that was an inappropriate consolidation between the other products case and a negligence case, and this seems to make the presentation of facts to the jury simpler?
But if it's an indivisible injury, I think under the Texas law, the number of defendants that are responsible can be allocated regardless of whether they're mixed products or negligence cases.
So by your argument, are you saying that they did wrong by filing those separate cases? In other words, are you saying that perhaps we should consolidate those cases in with your cases?
I've taken the position before the lower court that that those cases are cases that should be together because there is only one indivisible injury here.
So we should consolidate them with you?
The problem is, of course, those are individual cases. In other words, they have chosen there to file those as separate plaintiff's lawsuits. Here they file as many as 700 plaintiffs in one lawsuit. So it is difficult to go back and separate that all out now, but I think that what should happen is that there should be single filings of cases in which all defendants, both product and negligence defendants, are consolidated in the same case.
Are all those cases pending for pretrial is there a pretrial court?
There is no pretrial court on the premises cases. The plaintiff's counsel did make a point in their brief that there was an asbestos docket. That is true. That does not apply to the premises cases.
So these are cases that just happened to land in Johnstone's court?
That is correct. There was another group of cases of 700 or so that previously was in Judge Brister's court. As I said, there are roughly 365 additional claims that the Bailey firm, Williams Bailey firm, has against the premises defendants at this time.
Counsel, would you move to the harm aspect here and why it would be appropriate for this court to intervene at this time, even if we felt that that the trial court had erred?
Yes. Well, first on the error, on the position of error, our position is that here basically what the court did was rubber stamp what the plaintiff's counsel wanted by selecting 22 plaintiff's cases, the only criteria being that those cases had been disposed of in their products cases. There was no effort by the court below, to comply with Rule 174, which requires, I believe, that the court look at each case for questions of commonality, and once that is done, then you also have to determine whether prejudice is going to result to the defendants or to the plaintiffs, and whether or not jury confusion is going to result. So moving to the question then of whether or not mandamus should apply here, we feel that there was a clear, as said in Walker versus Packer, there was a clear failure of the trial court to analyze or apply the law correctly. That will constitute an abuse of discretion. What we're saying here is that the court's failure to analyze the cases individually and determine if they were consolidatable constitutes the clear abuse of discretion. Moving to the question of whether or not there is an adequate remedy at law, I think the court should look at the CSR versus Link case, where the court recognized that the large number of potential lawsuits, and of course that was in an asbestos context as well, the court found that the large number of potential lawsuits is significant to the determination that appeal is not an adequate remedy. That is certainly the situation in our case. We have 365 plaintiffs waiting in the wings as to the Williams Bailey firm alone, but that's not the end of it. In Beaumont, the Walter Humphrey Wayne Rio firms are very active in this. There are over 2,600 plaintiffs among those two firms making claims against some or all of these defendants. The Baron Perlman firm out of Dallas has another 1,900 cases that they have filed that also are cases involving some or all of these four defendants. So all total, we have at this time pending against some or all of these very defendants over 4,800 plaintiffs' cases. These are not cases that are obviously going to go away. These are being filed daily. So that was one of the questions I believe that the court addressed in the CSR versus Link. The number of cases is significant in terms of determining whether an adequate remedy at law exists.
Let me ask you this. Which particular client do you represent in this case?
I represent Ethel Corporation.
Okay. And let's say that some of these plaintiffs worked out at the Ethel Corporation site, worked there a year, and during that year they were exposed to asbestos. And then they went over to Todd Shipyards and worked there for 20 years, during which time they were exposed to asbestos. If the plaintiff sued your company, claiming that because they were exposed to asbestos at your particular work site, they should be entitled to recover damages from you, wouldn't you want to be bringing a third-party action to bring in Todd Shipyards to make sure that the jury would say, hey, most of their exposure was when they worked for Todd Shipyard instead of when they worked at Ethel?
I'm certainly either going to bring a third-party action. Of course, the plaintiffs are solving that for us by bringing them in as well. But I am either going to file a third-party action or at trial I'm going to be pointing to the empty chair. In fact, what we find in these cases is that there were a multitude of defendants where these plaintiffs work sites where these defendants work where the plaintiffs have chosen not to sue them. That we will certainly be pointing to that.
Why does that not undermine your argument that cases should be based upon a common work site?
Well, I think that common work site is one of the elements. I do not pretend to say that it is the only element, but I think that the court should examine the number of work sites in making a decision and in making a recommendation. It is just one of the factors I feel that needs to be taken into consideration.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Okay. The court is ready to hear argument from the lady.
Ready from the respondent. Mr. Richard, counsel will present argument for the respondent.
Thank you. Before the court takes complete control of my argument, I want to say three things. First, Judge Marshall's not involved in this case. This is not a breast implant case. And I am not sponsoring Mr. Radkin as an expert witness. Now, having said that, let me go.
In that connection, Mr. Countess, should there be a different standard in asbestos cases from breast implant cases?
Well, you always get into that kind of problem when you get into these situations. I don't know. I know what works in asbestos cases. And what you're really, I think, ultimately going to ask me, someone probably is, what standards, if any, do I think should be applied here? So let me just go straight to that, and I'll come back to I want to say a few words about the mandamus concept itself in this context, if I get the chance. But let me just go to the factors, and let's talk about those a minute. Now, in the supplemental brief that I filed, yes, it was just filed yesterday, and I should have filed it sooner, and I apologize, but basically what I was trying to do there was write the argument that I hope to make and probably won't get to. So I would ask the court to look at it because there is information in it that I think will be very helpful, particularly the opinion from the Second Circuit discussing, explaining, and analyzing the so-called Maryland factors, a subsequent opinion of the Second Circuit that I quoted extensively in my brief. Now,
and I take it you agree with that, since you quoted it extensively.
I agree with the overall impact of it, yes. I'm sure there are sentences in there that I would have to say no, I don't think that's correct, but yes.
But the concept is that there need to be standards. They can't be fixed. There has to be some flexibility, but there can be prejudice, and we've got to kind of work this out.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's, I can't argue with that, just based on the reality of the courtroom. But let me say two things about it. If you say these standards must be met, period, end of sentence, you're going to create an unworkable situation because no set of standards you formulate is going to fit all of the myriad kinds of group cases we're going to get in Texas that we have now or that we're going to get in the future. I think the most this court can do is say, here are some factors for the court to consider. Second, I think it would be an error for the court to put any numerical designation on the factors to say, well, you can consolidate if there is a satisfaction of a majority of those factors. My view is that the most the court can do is say, here are some things for the trial court to consider when consolidating. Now, my argument about the wording of the statute of the rule, I stand by because it says a common factor. If I have time, I'll go back and talk about that a little more. But let me talk about the factors as I see them.
And before you do that, is there an indication in this case that the trial court considered any factors? In the last case, the parties are suggesting to us fairly strongly that there was no consideration of any factor ever. And in this case, the record's not too much different. There is some consideration, but not
yes,
very much.
Just a sec. Let me ask you first. Please look at the transcript of those hearings. You don't have an arbitrary judge just saying do this and do that. You've got a judge that's thoughtful. She's trying to work through this and trying to figure out a way to bring these cases together so they can get disposed of. Now, she doesn't say, okay, here I'm considering this and this and this. In fact, what she does, she tells Mr. Cloud, who's the trial counsel, and the opposing counsel, to see if they can go work out a group. Well, that doesn't work, and I suppose, as he certainly has the right to, counsel was afraid he'd waive his complaint about consolidation. But what Mr. Cloud does is come up with a group that is a mixture of various kinds of cases. All of their products cases have been settled, so you don't have that issue involved in the case. That's going to go off in another direction. And they can be tried together because they are all premises-based liability cases.
In the sanctions area, we suggested that findings would be helpful to us because it would give us insight into why the judge was imposing the sanction. Would that same process be helpful here for an appellate court to know why the trial judge felt it was important to pick these 22 cases of 5 or 8 or 40 or however many?
I really don't have any problem with that. Based on my own experience, I know that it's always helpful to have some idea of what a trial judge is thinking when a particular decision is reached. You may or may not agree with that, or you may or may not think those factors are important, but I have no problem with that. I think it might be a good thing to do.
Mr. Countess, help me understand with regards to commonality.
Yes, sir.
The allegation is that the only thing the plaintiffs have in common in these cases are they have the same law firm and that the plaintiffs claim asbestos-related injuries, and that's all. There is no common, you know, if you track down the other factors that the courts have articulated, they don't meet any of those factors. They do not have a common work histories, common occupations, length of exposure or damages or diseases or smoking histories. Is that your statement? And if it's not, identify for me what these cases have in common other than what I've articulated here.
Right. I do not agree with that statement. First, let me just go down the list. Let's talk about the occupations. It is true that we have a group of people who did different things, but with one exception, all of them are what we call industrial craftsmen. They are men who, and, well, there's one woman, but she is there for a different reason. All of these men were industrial craftsmen. They worked out the building trades union, they worked with their hands, they constructed, they repaired, they tore down. They were the repairmen and the contractors, the builders, who went in and out of these various plants. They all did something approaching the same kinds of work, which means they were exposed under the same conditions, same circumstances. That's a similarity. And one of my pleas to this court is don't make any standards you set out too specific, because, again, if you do, you get into the problem of handicapping the trial court so they can't put together a reasonable group. Now, if you want to look at occupations from a more precise approach, certainly it depends on how specific you get, but on occupations, a division by, for instance, petrochemical workers, by industrial craftsmen, by office workers, by school teachers, that kind of division is a workable division, and this happens to be the industrial craftsmen group. There's nothing difficult about a jury understanding that. Now, the status of discovery, the same counsel, no question that those are the same. The other area, though, where I think there can be a real problem has to do with the disease itself. And this is one place where there's a major difference with breast implant cases. We don't have 50 different diseases running around out here with no history, no lack of understanding, or no strong dispute in most cases about their nature or their existence. You have a 20 or 30 year proven record, well, longer than that, actually about 50 year proven record of the effect of asbestos on the human body. It goes in, about 10% of it stays forever, never leaves. Ultimately, pleural plaques develop in the lungs. The progression from there is to asbestosis, and from there is to one of the cancers. And it's a straight line progression. Once you make the asbestosis list, you've got a greater than 50% chance of contracting a cancer, an asbestos-induced cancer. Straight line, right down the line. So there's no danger of either prejudice or jury confusion in combining, say, pleural plaques and cancers. Here's why. First, the diseases themselves, as I just said, are well known. Second, if you're trying all pleural plaques together, for instance, which are always your weakest cases, because these guys and ladies don't usually have any serious handicaps, but they do have the plaques and the prospect of other problems. If that's all you're trying all those together, you still show the entire history of the disease because you are entitled to future damages. You talk about asbestosis, you put on evidence of lung cancer, you put on evidence of meso, you put it all on. The jury gets the same picture.
But you say those are weaker cases. Why?
Because they're weaker in the sense that the effect of the disease on the human body is not as great as asbestosis or as the cancers. They are still serious cases, and the danger, obviously, is the progression much more than just the plaques themselves, although they do cause, according to most of the medical testimony, some impairment of breathing and stamina.
Well, how can it be a straight line if some of them cause mesothelioma and others cause lung cancer?
It is a straight line progression from plaques to asbestosis to some form of cancer, not necessarily the same cancers, but the cancers and the asbestos-related cancers.
In what percentage of cases?
From if you get asbestosis.
I mean, if you have pleural thickening, what percentage progress to asbestosis or some form of cancer?
I'm sorry, I do not have that percentage before me. I can find out and I will. I know that once you get to asbestosis, the medical testimony from our people, at least, is that there is a greater than 50% chance, of developing one of the asbestos-related cancers.
Is your point that in a pleural thickening case that you're going to be putting on evidence the probability of its progression to asbestosis and cancer?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
But it seems that evidence would appear differently if that plaintiff with only pleural thickening was sitting beside the widow of somebody who died of cancer or someone else who had progressed along. In other words, this may happen to me is not as strong an argument as here's a guy that it happened to.
Well, I think that's correct in the sense that a jury, when it starts to evaluate those cases, is going to consider that. There's no question that they're going to look at the guy with the pleural plaque and they're going to say, you're not nearly as sick as this guy over here. And so that's going to make a difference. And I put some affidavits from John Eddie Williams, some of the other people that have tried a lot of these cases with my material. I can get, obviously, as many as the court is willing to read. But what they show is that in all of these cases, the juries make a rational division between these various kinds of diseases. They don't. There is no history on a consistent basis. You may have a random weird case, but there is no history on a consistent basis of a jury awarding a crazy amount of money for a plaque just because somebody's sitting next to a cancer. There's just no evidence.
But what about causation? Isn't that an issue in the pleural plaque cases much more so than the mesothelioma or the asbestosis cases?
That the asbestos causes the plaques?
Or that
this person's asbestos caused the plaques?
Well, both. That the asbestos caused the plaque, or that the plaque will inevitably turn into something more serious. Don't you have a harder fight on the causation issue in the pleural plaque cases than you do in others?
I think it's probably somewhat, and I'm not as clear on this problem as I should be, the probability of moving from pleural plaque to asbestosis probably is not quite as great as the probability of moving from asbestosis to lung cancer. But as far as the basic causation, that is, either one, was this plaintiff's product, the defendant's product, the cause of these pleural plaques, or did asbestos cause these pleural plaques? I don't think that proof level is any harder for plaques than it is for the others. You've got to have some kind of causation testimony, both cause and fact and foreseeability. You've got to have some doctor who has been reputable and meets all the tests who can say this is probably an asbestos-induced disease. You've got to move all through those.
Well, what I'm saying is there a possibility or a likelihood, or how do we analyze this for a juror to say, well, here are 10 plaintiffs who do in fact have cancer. Here are 10 with pleural thickening, and just by the fact that there's so many people with the more serious diseases, I just assume that all of these 10 with pleural thickening are someday going to end up where these other 10 are.
Well, that's not the way our evidence is going to go, but whether the cancers are sitting there or not, we're going to be presenting basically the same evidence, which is that once you reach the asbestosis stage, at least, there's a greater than 50% chance that you're going to have one of the cancers. That's going to be true every time because we have the right to recover future damages. And
I'm talking about the pleural thickening.
Well, I'm sorry. I should be better prepared on the move from pleural thickening to asbestosis, and that's just an area I had not paid that much attention to. But the doctors are going to testify that is the progression. Now, I don't have a percentage I can give you. I'm sorry. But they're going to testify that that's the normal progression of the disease.
Do you think there is a maximum number of plaintiffs that can be tried together?
Our experience has been anywhere from 10 to 20, or 22 or 23 in the 20s, is the manageable group from everybody's standpoint on a general across-the-board basis.
Do you have any sense of how many cases in Texas multi-party asbestos cases have been tried to a verdict final on appeal without a settlement along the way in this area?
I have no idea, but I can find out.
I think there is only one that I know of in which there has been an appeal. That's out of the Texarkana Court some years ago, in which five plaintiffs were tried together. No question in that case about consolidation. Curious to me that we don't seem to see many of these on appeal.
Well, the consolidation issue is not generally a matter of contention. Most of the time what happens is just what Judge Stone wanted to hear. The parties get their heads together and they say, okay, let's try this group or this group. Even if they're unable to agree on which ones to try, there's usually not any contest if it's in the 10 to 25 range. People just go in and try them. I think, as a practical matter, most defendants and defense counsel recognize that that's a workable group, that in the long run they're better off, just as the plaintiffs are better off, to try them in these groups and get the cases disposed of. Now, I was intimately involved in that Chatham, the infamous Chatham case, 289 plaintiffs. The trial judge all of the trial counsel and everyone else I know who had anything to do with that case say they'll never try that many together again. Not because of jury confusion, but just because of the sheer burden of doing the job you have to do as either plaintiff or defense counsel to put on a good case. And they put on good cases. See, you have so many management devices available to you today to make good presentations that when we start talking about numbers, we're really talking about something superfluous. In Harris County, they have well-developed juror notebooks. And with those notebooks, the jurors can keep track of everything that's going on.
Your argument, I want to make sure I understand it, only works up to a point. I mean, all of those tools wouldn't work at 289.
There is a maximum number. Who knows what that number is? And that's part of the problem being done. Absolute standards. It's a shifting number. It depends on the case, depends on the facts of the case, depends on the kind of injury, depends on the attorneys. Are your attorneys skillful and seasoned at presenting this, or are they a bunch of amateurs who don't know what they're doing? Depends on the trial judge. So many of these cases are well tried if you have a good trial judge, badly tried if you have a bad trial judge. So it's a shifting group of factors.
Mr. Kanos, on talking about this shifting group of factors, and I know this is posed difficult. The rule talks about a common issue of law or a common issue of fact,
yes,
and obviously we're having to wrestle with that. Is there a distinction? My understanding of most of the asbestos cases is you've got the manufacturer, it's a products case. You have a manufacturer, and the real issue, and it seems that it has been decided by whoever decides these sorts of things that asbestos does cause cancer. There's some statistical significance to the incidence of cancer among those who are exposed to asbestos. So that issue's kind of out of it, and the only issue that's really left is, did I manufacture asbestos? And that seemed to be a problem because we didn't know who manufactured the asbestos 4 years ago, so we put all these defendants together and let that kind of sort itself out. On a premises liability issue, it seems to me the common issue, asbestos or causing cancer, is really not the issue that's being developed here. That the issue in premises liability is, did I, Ethel, or Toxicos, have asbestos at a place on the premises where this person was exposed? So it seems to me that you bring in this plaintiff, this plaintiff's issue is not going to be that asbestos caused my cancer. That's really not what we're going to be arguing about. What we're going to be arguing about is Bill Smith or Jane Doe was not at that place in my premises that exposed them to a significant enough exposure of asbestos. So it seems to me you'd have the significant issue in this case is not what is common to the cases. The significant issue in this case is what is really uncommon to these cases, and that is at Ethel Corporation, this plaintiff was not at the same place that caused significant exposure. And for Todd Shipyards, our plaintiff was not at that place. You see, my point is it's the significant issue that's not in common. It seems to me in a premises liability issue as opposed to a products liability issue for asbestos.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. I think certainly the method of putting these cases together and proving them is going to be somewhat different. Let me say that as far as I know all of them, and I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so, there's really not going to be anybody who can dispute the plaintiff's testimony as to where he was when. That evidence, I mean, the plaintiff knows and is going to testify about it. Most of the defendants, probably all of them, don't have any evidence to the contrary. So the average plaintiff is going to get on the stand and say, well, I worked 6 months here, then I took this job over here at this other place, and name the places that he or she worked. That's not going to be hard for a jury to keep up with, especially if they have notebooks. On the other hand, proving what the situation was at those various plants, if we've got four defendants or five here, we'd simply put on our evidence of what asbestos each of these five places had and where it was, and then relate that to where these various plaintiffs were.
So what's being fought about in these cases?
Well, there will be a fight over causation in the sense that they will, I'm sure, have some medical testimony. In many of the cases, they have medical testimony where they have doctors that say, no, we didn't find flags, or we didn't find something else. That's going to be a fight. There will be fights, I'm sure, over state of the art, state of knowledge. Since these are negligence cases, of course, it's no or should have known, and I'm sure that without looking at the evidence, and I haven't, it's going to be something to the effect that we didn't know when he was working here that these were problems, or something like that. And that's, I'm sorry, that's about all I can tell you right now.
Well, are those significant issues in this premises, are those the same that would be significant issues in a products case,
they
the state
be.
Of the art, and
yes.
that
yes.
sort of thing?
Yes, they can be, yes. I won't come back to this in just a second if I have time, but let me say one thing about Matt Davis. Please give us some guidelines. I don't know where I am when a man Davis hits my desk, except that I'm probably going to be down here as a representative of real party sometime not too long from now. But there are we have no guidelines to know when a mandamus should or should not be granted. You have said a lot of things, but then you will take a specific case that doesn't seem to fit those guidelines. Now,
if you can come up with a coherent theory, put it in a law review article.
You're asking the same question I used to ask, which is, what is the rule of law you want this court to write? I don't know. I can't tell you, other than if it's going to be tough problems, then just say any tough problem that needs attention, we're going to take a look at. If it's going to be abuse of discretion, if it's going to be no adequate remedy by law, the adequate remedy by law issue is not satisfied here. First of all, we're not talking about that in cases. Second, the best determination of whether there is either prejudice or confusion in this group of cases is to look at the trial record. You look at the evidence, you look at the jury's findings, and you talk to the jurors.
What about the link argument, which is really the only argument that Relator made, I think, about why this is a special case?
The CSR.
By the time we took this up through the regular appeal, there might be another 4,800 cases that have been erroneously disposed of.
I can't answer that. I only know what we have on file now. That's speculation, just as their expert's affidavit is speculation. I don't know. I have no knowledge of the people I represent that they plan to do anything like that, but I can't speak for anybody else.
Anything like that. But do you mean file cases, or how many of these same type of cases are there? The number was, opposing counsel said 4,800.
I don't know. I'm not aware of that. We don't have anything like that, so I don't know what the others have. But even so, no matter how many there are, even so, you've got to have some test of whether or not they're entitled to relief. And your court has said, all courts have said, show us prejudice, show us confusion. How do you determine prejudice and confusion? Well, you don't determine either one by their expert's affidavit if you look at that. You determine it by looking at the trial records. I've got affidavits from trial lawyers in these cases that outline what happens, and you see a logical division. No matter how many cases are tried, you see a logical division by the jury among the various diseases and the various problems. You find people poured out because the jury didn't like the causation testimony, and so on. Any other questions?
I have a question. But they seem to stress, the other side seems to stress, difference in diseases, and indeed they say in their brief that the medical testimony on lung cancer and mesothelioma differ quite a bit.
Yes.
So the state of knowledge, the state of the art, varying times is pretty distinct. Do you have a response to that?
Well, I don't agree, first of all, with their characterization of what the state of knowledge was. In any event, there's not a record before this court to satisfy that. But the division by disease is an artificial division that has no meaning for a lot of the reasons that I was talking about. You show the same thing regardless of whether you're trying plurals or cancers. The other thing that I think is going to happen, and I'm looking at a lot of these cases, I think what's going to happen in the long run, if it's divided that way, is that it's going to result in larger verdicts, not smaller ones. You group five cancer cases together and try them. Five people that have that asbestos-induced cancer, And with all of the liability evidence we have, you can make a jury very, very angry and they can put a whole lot of money on those columns.
Why aren't y'all consolidating them that way, if that's the case? I mean, why aren't the plaintiff's lawyers pushing to do that?
We think it's easier to put our proof together with an entire group that has a broad cross-section. But if
why
we
is that?
I'm sorry?
Why is it easy? Why, you would think it'd be easier.
Well, because you're talking about all of these things anyway, so why not have some of all of them in the trial itself? Plus, you can group more together. If you're going to try cancers, it's going to be hard to try 20 cancers at one time. But the medical testimony alone, when you've got a cancer, is harder. It's more difficult. It's more complex. If you've got a range, you can try more cases. Structure your evidence in such a way that it's easier for the jury to understand what you're dealing with.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Briefly, to address one comment that you made, Your Honor, concerning the question of the propriety of mandamus relief, and that the CSR was the only thing we mentioned. I did want to point out to the court that we have certainly pointed out the problem in terms of Rule 327B, that is that we cannot go behind the jury deliberations, and that was pointed out in the Dalbrier versus Basquetti or Basquette case, however it's pronounced. So I think that is certainly one of the two bases from which we say that mandamus relief should be proper here. The CSR.
Your point is you'll never be able to prove harm.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that is, if you look at the analysis that was done in the Dalbrier case, that is exactly what the court said. Is you'll never be able to go behind the jury and determine why they made their decision.
So all we have to rely on is sort of our intuition about what juries do.
That, and I think we could also look, in this same aspect, look at the Kane versus Armstrong case where you had a trial judge who did try 13 cases together, and he said after that obviously it was error, he recognized after the trial, and found that he had basically committed error, I suppose, in consolidating that many cases. It just didn't work, and it basically overwhelmed the jury with evidence, is what he found.
Is part of the motive here to settle out of cases with the thought that a large percentage of them will settle?
Certainly a large percentage of them do settle, no question about it.
Is there any indication that they settle because the prospect of going to trial with a whole lot of other people changes the settlement mix?
I think that was recognized, in fact, in the CSR versus Link, that really puts that these mass tort cases where there are a lot of consolidations put a lot of pressure on the defendants to settle. And so it is a very real problem that we face, no question about it.
But, I mean, if there were individual trials, given the legislature's feeling that the judiciary is adequately staffed, I mean, they've added very few judges in the last 10 years, none in the urban county. If they were tried one at a time, the pressure on defendants to settle would be pretty minimal.
Was that the court?
Minimal. You
yes.
could be a number 21,000 in line and feel pretty good about it.
And I think that, remember that eventually not all of these cases are going to be settled. Whether you consolidate five cases or whether or not you use one case, eventually the plaintiffs and the defendants are going to sort this out as to whether or not Ethel is going to be liable on a negligence action. In most cases, those cases are eventually going to, I think, cost
the settlement. How many of these negligence cases have been tried so far?
I'm only aware of one, Your Honor, and that is the Rita Mae Schmidt case over in Beaumont. Herschel Hobson was plaintiff's counsel, and in fact, in that case, it was a combination of the products and the premises defendants present, and the premises defendant was found not liable in that case.
So is your contention that this is more of an immature tort at this stage?
An immature what?
It's more like an immature mass tort rather than...
Well, it certainly is certainly not mature as is the products liability cases, Your Honor.
It seemed to me you want to make a distinction that this is a premises liability case as opposed to a products case.
Yes, Your Honor.
quiz Mr. Countess about the difference between a premises liability, what's at issue in a premises liability versus products, essentially his response is that the distinction is insignificant. You're really not going to be having a massive trial over whether or not these individuals were on your premises and were in a place to be exposed to asbestos. Your defense is really going to be, as the defense is in product liability, is that the asbestos didn't cause their cancer or whatever they're ailing from. Is that correct? Is that what really is going to be in spot in these premises cases?
Well, not entirely. In other words, we certainly take advantage of whatever the state-of-the-art evidence is, no question about that. But you always have to remember that in applying negligence standards, the question is whether or not we used ordinary care as it relates to that plaintiff on our premises at that particular point in time. And so the whole concept of duty, as recognized in Exxon versus Tidwell and some of the other cases, is at the forefront of these negligence cases. Whether or not a particular plaintiff was exposed in the same manner at a shipyard as he was at a steel mill, that's Todd and USX, is entirely different. You also have the different concepts of duty as it relates to the plaintiff's employer, because, for instance, after OSHA, specifically statutorily, the duty is on the employer to protect that employee, and the court has recognized in other cases in the not too distant past that you really have to look at the employer's responsibility, the contractor's responsibility, the owner's responsibility, and the plaintiff's responsibility and knowledge all at the time that plaintiff was out there. So it is not, you can't just take product defect in a vacuum as you can in the product liability suits.
Any other questions?
Thank you. So I conclude the oral arguments for today, and both of these causes will be submitted on briefs and arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.